We all have somewhere deep within us the belief that there is such a thing as friendship, true love, nobility, high qualities. We look around us, and very often in life we're disappointed. We're disappointed not only in others, but also in ourselves. And yet somehow this faith, deep-seated, endures. We're reaching out for something that we know. As Patanjali wrote in the Yoga Sutras, the experience of divine awakening is smriti, or memory. You awaken to something and say, oh, of course, this is what I am, this perfect love, this perfect joy. Before I go further, I would like to read something I wrote this morning. It is the Derek Bell. Would you stand, Derek, please? And let's greet him. Thank you for coming. It's a great blessing to have you. And he's going to be recording next week songs of mine with the harp. He's a famous harpist, as I think most of you know, as well as being the harpist for the chieftains. And he's a great musician and arranger, orchestrator, composer, and is very talented in every one of these fields. And so I wrote 12 melodies in the Irish manner, you might say, in the Irish style, for this album. And one I wrote was for a legend of Ireland called Deirdre. The woman was called Deirdre, and she was fabulously beautiful, and it was forecast for her life, predicted that she would cause great suffering. And so the king of Ulster decided that he would marry her to try to prevent — how it would prevent it, I don't know — but to prevent this suffering from happening. And he kept her in a secluded place far from everyone, just so that she would not see anyone and be seen and cause difficulties. But she did. When she grew up, she met a young man and ran away with him to Scotland with his two brothers. And the king, Conchobar, invited them back, promising safety. But as soon as they came back, he murdered the young man and his two brothers, and she committed suicide on his grave. So it's a great tragedy, and the music, I think, will reflect that. But I wanted, just as an introduction to this class, as you'll see why I'm doing it in a few moments, to read what I wrote this morning for it. It isn't lyrics, it's just the sort of mood that she was in at the end of her life. Oh, it's suffering only my great beauties brought me, and all them my life has touched. Suffering and death for Nisi, my beloved, and his brothers. Suffering for Conchobar, the great king, who, when age came upon him, grew foolish, pining for me. A traitor he is, truly, and a murderer. Suffering for his people, who have now lost the king's wisdom and guidance. Suffering for me, too, for what am I but a poor woman only, cursed with beauty to be worshipped when she wanted to be loved. And what fools we, all of us, that think beauty's anything but a memory of what we all knew once in our souls. It's death, surely, death only, that such beauty brings. She stabs herself, and in death falls on her lover's grave. The subject today is superconsciousness. And superconsciousness is not a state we attain. It is not, as people describe it, an altered state. It's the only true state. What we're living now is the altered state. Conscious and subconscious are the altered states. This is not what we really are. Consciousness, as I've written in my new book, which will come out in the spring, called Superconsciousness, consciousness is absolute. It's the only reality. It's the reality out of which all things have sprung. It's the essence of matter. Matter couldn't exist if it weren't conscious, if it weren't consciousness that had brought it into manifestation. This is totally the opposite of what all, virtually all, modern science thinks. And yet, more and more far-seeing scientists reaching out into the future, into infinity, are beginning to think that really it looks as if everything were just a dream of some cosmic mind. That we know, science has proven, that matter, which for a long time people thought was the ultimate reality, or at least a permanent reality, atheists think of it as the ultimate reality, that in fact matter doesn't even exist. Matter is only a vibration of energy. The reality of matter, then, is a delusion. We think that we're sitting on something solid. I was watching I have a little pool with a waterfall in my back garden, and I was watching the insects that can skate along the top of that water because they're so light, they don't break the surface tension. And I thought that in a way, we too are separated only by surface tension. Our skin is a kind of surface that has the tension that makes it difficult for anything to penetrate and makes it seem as if we're separate from other people. But in fact, nothing is separate from anything else. Everything is a part of one consciousness. If you could penetrate to the reality of a single dot on a page, a period on a page, if you could penetrate to its ultimate essence, you would find suddenly that you understand the essence of everything. You don't need to read libraries of books. You don't need to go to college and learn. What you need to do is unlearn all the delusions that we have had foisted upon us by our senses, by our conditioning, by society, by our learning in school, all of these things that make us think that this outer world is our reality, when in truth the reality is something far, far deeper, and a reality that once you've touched it anywhere, you understand it everywhere. That's why Master wrote in Autobiography of a Yogi that wonderful definition of divine vision: center everywhere, circumference nowhere. I asked a great saint in India, Anandamoyi Ma, once, "Why don't you come to America? Many people there would love to see you." She said, "I don't need to go, I'm there already." This is the consciousness of an enlightened person, that he's here, he's there, he's everywhere. And he doesn't need to go anywhere to understand it. I remember once talking to Master and mentioning that one of the monks at Mount Washington, we were out at the desert, and one of the monks at Mount Washington was going through a difficult time, and Master suddenly said, uh-oh. He saw this would be his death spiritually. But he understood it instantly, because his consciousness was at that center where you know everything is with you. There is no distance, there is no time, it's all an illusion. And so we live in with a brain that seems to produce the consciousness it expresses, but in fact it's the consciousness that produced the brain. It's infinite consciousness that created lots of little vortices of energy that produced the different atoms of the universe, each one with its own individuality, its own separate identity, and yet also each one a manifestation of itself, which is the infinite. And if you take it to that level, you can't even say that God is infinite. You can't even say that God is omnipresent, because the omnipresence implies space. Infinity implies vastness. There's nothing vast about something that just is. That reality ultimately is just, it just is. And that's who you are. Scientists keep trying to find out what consciousness is. How did consciousness come into manifestation? They think that it was a matter of the brain. Descartes said that I think, therefore I am. In fact, if you weren't, you wouldn't be able to think. That thought that you're aware, that ability to think, is an intuition. Nothing tells you that you exist. This is a point that I've explained in this book, the point Buddha made when he talked about nirvana. That nirvana is not, as Buddhists today think and most people believe, complete extinction. It's extinction of all those things that you aren't. It's extinction of desire, of fear, of hope, of thinking that I'm a man or a woman, of wanting this, of fearing death, of being able to be ill, all the various things that human beings experience. All of that is extinguished, and you're left with only one thing, and that is the simple consciousness that you are. And in that absolutely stripped consciousness, then comes bliss and infinite love and all those qualities that we think of as divine. But it's only to the extent, because it's not a closed door and then something else happens, it's only to the extent that you can extinguish your self-definitions, your self-limitation as a human being, as an ego, as a body, as a being with desires and attachments and hopes and fears. All of these, the more you can get rid of that thought, the more you find everything that you've wanted coming to you. Because it's not like a desert that you have to go for miles and hundreds of miles and finally find an oasis. It's rather like a desert that blooms, and the farther you go, the more the flowers, the more the grass, until finally you come into a verdant valley and are surrounded by beauty. The spiritual path is not a long, lonely, desolate journey. The spiritual path is a constant growing in joy and in love and in all those things that we most deeply want. Because any time that we think we want a thing, it's really something that we want in that thing. We think that cottage by the sea will give us peace. But if that's where we're looking for our peace and we finally get the cottage, we finally get bored. Master used to say, when you reach that state, you're like saying, hit me on the head to see if I'm alive. And so you begin wanting to create all those old desires all over again that brought you all the suffering and the ups and downs that are human life. Then you get so sick of that for a while, and you've suffered so much, and you think, oh, I want just peace, so let me get that cottage by the sea. Well, so you get another cottage by the sea. And it's the round that goes on, life after life after life, each time thinking that, well, I didn't make it as a merchant, but maybe I'll make it as a sailor. Well, I didn't make it as a sailor, maybe I'd get better luck if I were a pirate. And then you just, all these different things that you experience before you finally decide, I don't know where to look, except I know I'm something, and I might as well explore who I am. And in that exploration, in that exploratory journey, you discover that you aren't any of those things, that what you really are is, and it's been coming to you more and more. It's like when you go out from Los Angeles toward the East Coast on, what is it, Highway 60 or 66? I forget. Anyway, you come to Banning, and if it's the way it was many years ago, you see a big sign outside Banning or Whitewater where it says, it advertises some hotel in New York. That's 3,000 miles away. You've got an advertisement. Well, you go quite a long distance further before you see another advertisement for a hotel in New York. But the closer you get to New York, the more advertisements and billboards you see, until finally you're there. Well, it's the same thing with the spiritual path. You first get little glimpses, maybe a glimpse of the spiritual eye, some little advertisement that, yes, you'll get a good rest when you get there, the divine hotel, you might say, and they become more and more you begin to feel. You don't know where it's coming from, but you just find that you're happy. You find that you're getting a fulfillment that you didn't have before. You find that tests don't throw you in the same way. And so bit by bit, you begin to think, oh, New York, New York, or God, God, and there you are. And then you're surrounded by it. But the brain doesn't produce consciousness. A computer could not be designed to produce consciousness unless, here's an interesting unless, it were able to be so perfect that it would invite a disincarnate being to work through it. But otherwise it wouldn't work, because consciousness is the it's the ultimate bedrock reality. You can't create it. All you can do is bring it into manifestation. And so meditation is not a process of reaching up towards something that you are not. Meditation is reclaiming that which you already are. Now that should be a thought that should permeate your entire being. So that you always try to remember that that's who you are, and therefore that's how you should live. To learn to live superconsciously is a large part of what this book is about, although I really only put that part about superconscious intuitive living in the last chapter. But the attitudes that are superconscious are altogether different from those that are normal to human consciousness. Because human consciousness, when we're living with the rational mind, what we see is division. We're always asking the question, how does this differ from that? We're always analyzing and seeing distinctions. It's the way the conscious mind works. But in working that way, what it does is break up and divide. Whereas the superconscious sees unity. And in seeing unity, it sees oneness in every experience. It sees that, well, to bring it back a little bit further, when God created the universe, His Spirit was one. And the only way that He could bring it into manifestation was to not bring something else into manifestation over here. He wasn't like a carpenter who makes a desk by going out and buying the wood and making it here. It's always from a center. I remember going to the Joffrey Ballet in New York and being intensely dissatisfied with the ballet because some bright choreographer had the idea that we need to keep going in creativity and just creating from one thing something else evolves and from that something else evolves. And so instead of the movements always coming back to a center, which is normal in dance, it kept evolving from each, going further and further away from that center. It's not the way our nature is made. It's not the way truth is. It's contrary to reality because we are always in ourselves at that center. Center everywhere, circumference nowhere. God Himself couldn't create the universe except moving in opposite directions from that center in the middle, you might say. That movement, like a tuning fork, you strike it and it moves and creates sound. So that calm center that is spirit vibrated itself, and in that vibration it produced what appears to be the universe, but is really only a manifestation. That movement, left and right, up and down, in and out, this is what makes the appearance of duality. That's why it's vibration. That's why the atoms are constantly moving, constantly vibrating. There are very interesting facts about the atom. If you were to split the atom, split the electrons, separate the electrons, they would seem separate, but they're really, their movements, everything is simultaneous, because they're really not separate. There is a oneness in them, just as there is, you might say, in twins, but it exists everywhere in the universe. God brought this universe into manifestation through vibration. Now, what we need to do in thinking superconsciously is to see in everything its opposite, oneness. It's like a pendulum. You swing the pendulum this way, it'll swing an equal distance the opposite way. The farther you swing it this way, the farther it will swing that way. But in that swing is already its opposite. If it weren't there, if the potential to go there weren't there, then the pendulum wouldn't be able to move. The potential becomes the kinetic. If consciousness were not already inherent in the first atoms, then it would never have become manifested. You can't have something in manifestation that isn't there potentially from the beginning. Consciousness had to exist potentially before it could be manifested. And so its potential manifestation is there. And in every ill, there is a cure. For every sorrow, there's also a joy. As Satya Sai Baba puts it, sorrow is an interval between two joys, and joy is an interval between two sorrows, and thus the world goes on. If you can understand that, then you're beginning to think superconsciously. When people come to a problem, they usually see the problem. I remember in Italy, because they have a lot of problem consciousness there, it's in their language even, and I would give advice to them, and invariably, I don't think there's been an exception in my experience, but there may have been one or two, after giving them this advice that I thought would help them, they say, ma, è difficile, but it's difficult. When you're problem conscious, what you attract is problems. When you're solution conscious, what you attract is solutions. And there is a solution to every problem, because the problem could not exist without its solution. So if you want to think superconsciously, again, think in terms of solutions to the problems that you face. Think in terms of, what can I do about it? Not, why is it difficult, it can't happen, people have tried it, it never worked. People who invent, people who create, they invariably have that superconscious mentality that says, there has to be a way of doing it. I found it very interesting in working on this book, because Warner First, a year ago, Warner Books, told me they wanted me to write a book on meditation, and they wanted the title Meditation for Starters. Well, that seemed like a very easy book. I thought I could write that one with my left hand tied behind my back, so to speak. But then, come this spring, they said, no, they didn't like that title. They wanted another title. And they said, Superconsciousness. Well, you can't just take a title and plaster it on a book. If you've got another title, you've got to write another book. And because of my operation and all the recovery from that and so on, I wasn't really able, the rapid heartbeat that I had for weeks before it and so on, I wasn't able to put my mind to writing it. But then, come April, I finally got the word that they wanted this book on superconsciousness by the end of April. You don't do that kind of thing, unless you're somebody like a master who just sort of does like that, like Satya Sai Baba materializes. Perhaps I could have done that with the book, but other than that, to write this book in 2 weeks was not possible. It would have taken me normally at least a year, quite possibly 2 years. It was a major work. I could see that it was bound to be the major work of my life. Such a subject demanded that it be. And so they gave me till June 30th. That gave me 2 months to write a book that I had to do in, I would have done normally in a year or two. And it was a very interesting experience for me. May have been somewhat defined differently by some of you who wanted to get in touch with me or get me to answer a letter or whatever, because I just had to absolutely close the door and pretend that nothing else existed. And just think nothing but this book. But again, I found it really interesting, because many times, you know, you come to a real philosophical conundrum, and the tendency of the mind is to say, well, we got to think about this one. And a week later you come up with the answer, but I had no week later to think about. Try this yourself. I just put out much more energy saying, okay, I've got to have an answer. I know there's an answer. Here it is. And again, that's how the book came, that with that higher level of energy, with that complete dedication of energy, and none of that thinking that I can't do it, it's too difficult, I really have to think it over and take my time and so on. By putting out that kind of affirmative energy, superconscious energy, suddenly I knew what to say. And the book is full of things I'd never even thought of before. But I knew they were true. They were the result of living and thinking and years, 50 years nearly of teaching. And I think it is a great book. But the point is that it comes from a method that all of us can apply. And that is, think superconsciously. Be solution-oriented, not problem-oriented. Know that there is an answer, and then put the energy out. How many popular songs have you heard that became popular only because of their first line? It's as if, maybe in sleep, maybe in an idle moment when they were relaxed, suddenly an inspiration came. They got this beautiful melody, and then they didn't know how to make it happen. Beyond that, their energy level decreased, and so what could they do then but just sort of put it together with their minds? They had to create it. It was a brain product, not a soul product. It wasn't intuitive. Well, if they had held that energy up, as really successful music is, then they would find the energy would keep coming. Hugo Wolf, who was a great composer of songs in Germany in the last century, had long periods when he couldn't write anything, and I think it was finally the sheer frustration of that that drove him mad. But Yogananda was asked the question once, is it possible for inspiration to be under the control of one's will? And he was busy preparing to go and give a talk, and he just stopped and sat down. He said, yes, take down this poem. And he dictated a poem that was beautiful. In fact, when his book, Whispers from Eternity, came out, that was included in it. And a reviewer said, there's one poem in this book that is so beautiful, I can't resist quoting it. And he quoted that poem. Hugo Wolf, if he had known that, could have done the same thing. Anyone can do the same thing. It's not a question of some individual talent. It may seem that way because a person may be born with it. A Mozart who could write his first music at the age of 15. Lovely story about Mozart was that one time somebody asked him, how do you write a symphony? And Mozart said, well, you don't write symphonies that easily. First you have to write simple things and maybe little short piano pieces and so on, and work your way up gradually to where you can write a symphony. And the person said, well, you didn't do all that. You wrote symphonies right away. And he said, yes, but I didn't have to ask. He knew. That was a talent. But talent is only something that you've developed, maybe over many lifetimes, until finally it comes naturally. And it all comes down to the same thing. Anybody in this crowd can do the same thing. It may take them a little while. But you can be as creative as the greatest creative genius. You can find answers to any question if you can just learn the simple principles that are involved. One principle is energy. Put the energy out and it generates a magnetic field that attracts to you the inspiration that you need. That's what I did when I was working on this book or when I've worked on music or whatever. Put the energy out, just refusing to accept that negative thought in the mind that says, oh, it's difficult. Oh, you've got to think this over. Oh, you can't do it. Oh, what training have you had for it? Other people have tried. They haven't succeeded, and so on. Just say, well, other people have done it. I'm a person. I too can do it. We're all basically the same thing anyway. And if you have that kind of faith and put out that kind of willpower and energy, then that's the first step to finding solutions to any problem that you're looking for, that you want. You'll find your brain then begins to enter onto that wavelength. You attune yourself to that wavelength, and then you understand. I know when I wrote the Psalm of David, I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord, who made the heavens and the earth. And a friend of ours, Shivani, who is super Jewish, or was before she came to Ananda, she said, I know you've never been in a synagogue, but it's just the kind of thing a cantor would sing at a synagogue service. And I didn't say, oh, I'm glad to hear that. I said, I know. I've never been in a synagogue, but I know. How do you know? Because it comes from a level where you do know. And it just has to be that. It can't be anything else. That's the kind of certainty that comes to you when you draw on the intuition. You know this is the right way to go, that you know this is the right thing to do. And so, that's a part of it, having that energy that you put out. The next thing is that you have to know that it doesn't come from you. It comes from another source. You have to, in other words, hold it up to the superconscious. The superconsciousness is literally above, in the sense that the higher chakras are that part of our consciousness in which we attune ourselves to what we really are. And the lower part are that in which we're in tune with the body, the senses, and so on. So the more the energy rises, the more we're able to feel that inspiration coming to us. As the more you think of generating this inspiration with your own mind, and a part of the delusion with that is, yeah, but I'm the creator, it's me who's doing it. Get rid of that thought. You're not doing it. You don't and can't do anything of your own. You know why? Because you aren't even yourself. You don't, your personality is not who you are. Your body is not who you are. It's an aggregation of qualities that you've acquired over many incarnations of reacting this way and that way to different things and circumstances and people. There is only one thing that's you, and that is uniquely you, and that's the wonderful thing about the truth. That at the time of your creation, who knows how many billions of years it was, in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam explained, Master says, that many who are wandering in delusion now will still be wandering in delusion at the end of this day of Brahma, which lasts for billions of years. And so, you've been around a long time, but at the beginning of all that, you were created uniquely you. No one else will ever be that. And there's some unique consciousness in you, some unique individuality in you, which isn't your personality, but somehow determines your reactions, which will be different from anyone else's in the whole universe. Trillions, quadrillions, any kind of numbers of people, none of them will be exactly like you. You are that essence, which will determine that if you're a pirate, you'll be your kind of pirate. If you're a merchant, you'll be your kind of merchant. Anything that you do, although everybody presumably has been through all of these things, and everybody's been a pirate and a merchant and a thief and a whatever it might be, everyone's been all of those, and yet no two people have been them in the same way. There's still that individual, which as Master wrote in Autobiography of a Yogi, you remember how he said that liberated souls in the astral world, earth-liberated souls, are able to recognize old friends, even though their outward form has changed radically, and yet they can always recognize this germ of the individual whom they knew and perhaps loved many, many lifetimes ago. And in that, they come to gain a new sense of the universal kinship of all mankind, of all creation, because we're all just parts of that same, and yet each one is there to have a kinship with others. So you, underneath your personality, when you've stripped your personality of all its likes and dislikes, its tendencies and desires, all of that, there will still be not just you as a little atom in creation, but that unique you, which can never be changed, that will remain with you in nirvana, and that will remain with you when you go beyond that state of nirvana into the infinite state of oneness with God. As Master said, Jesus said it first. He said, seek the kingdom of God first, and all these things will be added unto you. And you don't lose anything, and that's where Master in his Gita interpretations, which unfortunately have not come out yet, but he wrote that you don't even lose, in infinity, you don't lose your individuality. That is to say, you are God, you become one with God, you become He, but you know that it was God who became also that unique person. And you can bring that person, that individuality, into outward manifestation again anytime a devotee calls to you. It's not as if suddenly you become unconscious, you become so supremely conscious that you don't lose that memory which remains with you for eternity of having been an individual. Now that is what we want to understand when we try to create, because the thought that I'm creating is actually a block to creativity. The thought that I'm doing is actually a block to success. The more we get rid of that thought, the more we find this inspiration coming in and inspiring that deeper individuality that is ours, so that everything that you do, yes, God does it through you, but on the other hand, you have to be the filter for it. So that whatever music Mozart wrote, it was definitely Mozart, although it wasn't his own music. but it came through that filter. So it will still be unique. You don't have to worry about then sort of becoming a nameless blob. So in your meditation also, try to get back to that individual essence that is you. That essence of thoughtlessness, not blank mind, but still consciousness. That essence of love, which doesn't have likes and dislikes and doesn't say, I love you. Just becomes love itself. The more still you become in meditation, the more these things will manifest. But what you need to do first, Earth is a training ground. In this world, we have to train for superconsciousness. Our job in life is to achieve superconsciousness. That's what we were made for. As St. Augustine said, thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find rest in thee. We were made only for that purpose. You have to live in the thought then, on this training ground of Earth, that you are a superconscious being, not a human being. When people say to you, oh, I'm only human, say, no, what you mean is you're not yet human. Because to explore our humanity is to discover our full potential as human beings. To discover our true potential as human beings is to discover that we are reflections of God and nothing else. Nothing else is real. So live in a godly way now if you want to live as you really are. And you'll find that in your meditation too, it will come to you more easily, that superconscious state. As you live in this world, don't think that, well, I know I'm mean. You're not mean. You've lived in meanness because that's been a personality trait that you've developed. Get rid of it. It's not you. Don't let people say you're evil because you're not. Even the worst criminal never will say, I'm evil. Because he knows deep in himself that there is goodness. When Dillinger, public enemy number one back in the 30s, was killed in a shootout with the police, they found a note by his body where he'd scrawled, I have been much misunderstood, and in this body there's a very loving heart. Public enemy number one. He'd killed I don't know how many people. Still, he couldn't believe that he wasn't that goodness. Because he wasn't. Because he was that goodness. He wasn't that evil. All of us, no matter how we live, are children of that same Father. And if we can learn to see that goodness in others, try to be on their side, even when they talk against you. Try to see that there is goodness there somewhere, misunderstood, misunderstanding, and yet it's there. Try to see when people calumniate you, that really they're hurting themselves. It's like Milarepa when he was an old man and he was living in a cave. I don't know how old he was actually because he lived a long life afterwards, I believe. But he was in a cave eating nothing but nettles. That's all there was growing around it. So he made nettles with water and called it soup and he ate nettles. And I hope they weren't stinging nettles. But anyway, that was his diet until gradually his whole body turned green. And some hunters, seeing him, thought he was a ghost or something, and they ran away when he called out to them, and when they found out that he was human, they sort of took out their anger at having been fearful by beating him up. And Milarepa only felt suffering for them, because he knew how much suffering they would go through for doing something to a fellow creature. They were really beating themselves and didn't know it. They were really incurring this pain for themselves, not to him. He wasn't touched by it. So we should have that kind of compassion. Even when we know that people are wrong, we should know that anything that they do, if you see somebody who's wrong and help him, you overcome that wrong in yourself. But if you condemn him, you become that even more yourself. You suffer 1,000 times more. And so when you see somebody like that, give him, at least mentally, give him love. He may not understand it outwardly, but inwardly pray for him or pray for her. Because the superconscious way is to see that God is in you in that form also. You are in that form. You are going to be suffering through maybe many lives for the mistake that you are making in that form. And then also tell yourself that I am responsible for this form, and I will not fall into that delusion by responding with hatred, by responding with a desire to hit back, to hurt. Rather, let me be grateful because in that gratitude, I will win my freedom. Anytime somebody talks against you, hurts you, tries to destroy you, they're doing you a big favor. For one thing, they're helping you to get rid of bad karma. Well, you want to get rid of it sooner or later, why not sooner? So it's a good thing. They're giving you the incentive to an opportunity to express and compassion, to feel compassion for others, to feel forgiveness for others. They're giving you a resolution to become stronger in yourself. All of these things can be turned good. There's nothing in this world that's bad. All of it ultimately is neither good nor bad. It's just neutral. It becomes good or bad according to your reaction. So what you need to do always is go back to that simple thought that all of this is just a storm. I am the central reality. Nothing defines it. Nothing can slide.